Hello everyone. I'm James Collier. I'm your chair for the session. I'm also the National Managing Partner of KPMG Actuaries. Rob Curtis is going to be our presenter today. Just a couple of words on Rob. So Rob's also KPMG. He's our global regulatory lead for insurance. Rob's worked in KPMG in the UK, the Americas, Asia, and about to be Africa, and he can tell you all about the number of shots he's had in his arm today. He's recently been dragged back to Australia to send his kids to school. But prior to joining KPMG, Rob's held senior roles in the FSA in the UK, where he developed the UK ICAS regime and led the FSA's Solvency II program. Prior to joining the UK FSA, Rob successfully led risk and capital transformation projects at the largest UK life and non-life firms, respectively. Rob's also provided assistance to the Association of British Insurers for their Solvency II program, drafted the CRO forum paper on recovery and resolution plans, and leads KPMG's global response for insurance on systemic risk issues. Rob has too many qualifications to mention and seemingly collects master's degrees for a hobby. He's got a master's of management, a master's of business in financial services, and an MBA. I'll hand over to Rob to do our presentation. We'll take questions just at the end, I think.
Yeah, that might be the best. Thanks, James, and good afternoon, everyone. And yes, this is very much an emerging issue, I think, and so emerging that we haven't quite got the numbers in here yet. But I suspect in 12 months' time, this will look quite a bit different in terms of the interest level, because once APRA starts to apply this domestically, I think that will change the scene quite a bit. So what I want to do today is just take you through what this all means. You probably have heard a lot of this in terms of the banking requirements, particularly around living wills. And this is something that is now coming across to the insurance sector. It's very much something that the IAIS, that's the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, not many people have necessarily heard of the IAIS, but they are the Basel equivalent for insurance. They are the international standard setter for insurance, believe it or not. And they are now tasked with a lot of work from the FSB, the Financial Stability Board, to try and get something in situ for the insurance sector. So I'll take you through that. What are the main developments? What's the sort of background briefly? Why and where and how we've got to where we are today? Then look at, in more detail, the ISB requirements coming through the IS, and then look at the GCDC issues. So that's the Global Systemically Important Insurer, and then the domestic equivalent. So, recap, just what's the rationale for reform, why, how have we got here? Effectively, this all really generated from the financial crisis, and I think it was fair to say that, and I was in supervision at the time that all this was in some strife, and you know, there's been a long time criticism, effectively, of the insurance sector, and that is that unlike banking, there isn't a global framework in which the supervisors can all assess, particularly the large internationally active insurance group. So, as you know, in insurance, plenty of acronyms. There's another one, IAIGs, not to be confused with AIG, but the IAIG is quite a new acronym which has entered the fray now. And effectively, as supervisors, there was really very little that the supervisors had to properly assess the financial condition of firms globally. And that was largely because everyone does something different. So APRA has its set of requirements. You go to the UK, it had a separate requirement, and now you've got Solvency II coming in. The NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners in the US, they have their set of requirements, FSA Japan. So you go all around the world, and everyone's got a different set of requirements for insurers. And so the FSB, in its wisdom, said, well, look, we know what Basel is, and we know what Basel requires of the banks, but actually we've got no idea how you would actually manage a systemic risk issue in the insurance sector, because you actually don't have a global framework. So how would you do that, insurance supervisors, collectively amongst yourselves? And that's where they're all like, well, we know what our system is, we don't really know what theirs is or theirs, and, you know, and we try our best, but we actually, it's a little bit haphazard. So they said, all right, you actually need to get a framework together. And, you know, we're going to put this under a SIFI issue. So the systemically important financial institutions that they came up with, they said, actually, we think that will apply to banking, and we also think on the insurance side, it probably applies to you as well. So if you look at the objectives that the FSB are trying to set, quite straightforward, really, and what they're really trying to do is say, at the core of it, you know, there no longer can be recourse to the government of the day to bail out a failed institution. That's really where they're trying to get to. You know, if you sort of strip back everything else that they're really, you know, talking about in terms of other key objectives, that's really at the core of what they're trying to do. And it's very much a political one. It's influenced very heavily by the G20, who, as a result of the crisis, particularly on banking, said we just can't actually afford to bail out anyone else if there was another crisis, and therefore we've got to do something about this. So they gave that, the G20, to the FSB, and they said, you know, for goodness sakes, try and, you know, come up with something. So the FSB then went to Basel for the Basel Committee for Banking and said, you know, what are you going to do? And likewise, they went to the IAS. And as you can see there, it's really to, you know, the four or five key areas, but preserve economic functions, you know, minimise the contagion risk, look at, you know, how you could transfer the business in the event of a crisis, you know, sort of an orderly runoff type requirement. And basically, you know, as I was saying, try and have the sort of least impact possible for taxpayers, effectively. And so what they've done is constructed a set of requirements for banks, and then said, actually, we think this equally applies to the insurance sector. And, of course, as you can imagine, that has created its own, you know, storm of interest from the sector, particularly around the issue of actually are insurers systemically relevant in the first instance or not. And that debate probably went on for about 2.5 years, actually. So the insurance supervisors themselves have been somewhat persuaded that the insurance sector is fundamentally different to banking. So, for example, you know, you don't have to resolve an insurer over the course of a weekend like you might a large bank. You know, you don't have that sort of run-on effect. You don't have the, you know, usual sort of liquidity issues that you do on the banking side. And so it's a fundamentally different business, you know, pre-funded rather than, you know, deposits. It's very much a different beast that you're dealing with, asset transformation. The whole sort of, you know, investment banking components are also a different element to insurance. So they basically said, okay, we accept at that level that there probably is enough differentiation between banking and insurance. But having said that, actually what really caused AIG's, you know, difficulties, for example, and they looked at it and they said, well, it's the financial products division. What were they doing? They were dealing in, you know, investment banking type activities. You know, so all of the CDSs and, you know, those sorts of financial instruments, derivatives, etc., were really at the core of what was very difficult for AIG to manage at the end of the day. And so they said, well, you know, there might be instances where that also happens again. And if it does, insurer, are you actually adequately across all of these risks? And if you spoke to anyone from AIG beforehand, before the crisis, they would tell you that they had the best risk management systems money could buy. They knew exactly their exposures. They knew everything that there was, as far as they were concerned. And this is why in the States still there is quite a significant, you know, model skepticism from the insurance supervisors, because they heard this a lot from, you know, the AIGs of the world in that part of the world, and heard the statements a lot, you know, that you trust us, we know what we're doing, the risk management frameworks are fine, you know, we know our exposures, we've got everything, your money goodbye, there isn't an issue. And of course the largest ever corporate bailout just happened to be an insurance group, being AIG. So you know, that sort of came back, if you like, the chickens came home to roost, and that's where you have a real issue now in the States about them actually believing anything around models, you know, because they're just, this is the insurance supervisors, quite sceptical about the claims that are made and how well insurers really understand their risks. So there's a little bit of context there in terms of some of the present day issues with getting a common framework going at the IAS level. But that's another sort of story, if you like. But that sort of, you know, that debate, nonetheless, is really what's at the core of it. So that's what they call the non-traditional, non-insurance, NTNI. So, again, another acronym. But effectively, the IAS looked at this and said, okay, we think that there's NTNI business, which you're probably at risk. So all of those sorts of, you know, financial instruments, anything with a real market risk, and we'll go through some of that a bit later. And now, increasingly, around large annuity books. So effectively, it's quite political, all of this. And the insurance supervisors don't want to be caught in case, you know, one of your large, particularly in the UK, say, life you know, annuity writer was unable to suddenly meet annuitant payments. The last thing they want is angry you know, people on the streets demanding their money. So that sort of caused another, you know, area of interest, particularly for the life assurers, to say, well, actually, you know, maybe you need to also undertake this recovery resolution type analysis work as well. So what you've got here is the FSB outlining some very high level, you know, sort of principles about what they're going to do. So they've got this capital surcharge that they're thinking about. And in insurance, this is what's called the higher loss absorbency, HLA. Again, another acronym. But what they're going to do basically is say, look, come 2019, if you still have residual risk, particularly around NTNI business, then we will probably apply a capital surcharge to that. So it's the old carrot and stick approach. You know, we really want you, insurer, to actually get on board and understand and manage those sorts of financial risks. Recovery resolution plan is going to be at the core of all of this. RRPs. So this is something that, again, has been, you know, promulgated quite deeply on the banking side and has cascaded across now very firmly into insurance. And so you're already starting to see this for those groups who have been designated, and I'll go through that in a minute. And then what they're really trying to do is harmonise some of these resolution tools that the supervisors have got. So they're actually trying to say, if in the event of crisis we need to, you know, get together as supervisors to work out what we might do to, you know, look at the solvency of this particular group, we've got to have a mechanism in which to do that. So I was in Budapest at the time when we had the crisis. All of the supervisors were there, and you literally had the Asian supervisors in particular with the AIG group, you know, behind closed doors saying, we have no idea what's happening with this group. You know, we want information. And the US supervisors, interestingly, said, well, actually, that's not us. That's, you know, the NAIC and the state-based supervisors were saying we weren't responsible for the AIG group supervision. That was the small thrift supervisor down the road, and that poor old person was there trying to explain what was happening, and they had absolutely no idea of the extent of magnitude of the issues involved. So that really caused a lot of people to start thinking around the supervisory community about, right, we've got to get a better mechanism amongst ourselves so that if something like this happens in the future, we know what to do. And so that sort of led on to this whole cross-border supervision and the whole, you know, merging towards this idea that actually, rather than each country trying to supervise their own large group, maybe we need a college process. So the supervisors got together and said, well, maybe we need a supervisory college approach. And that is where basically now you're getting the biggest action, if you like, in terms of the supervisory community, because they're now, you know, if you're supervising a large group, it's not just yourself. Say, what's a good example? Say, any of the large UK groups, you will have now four or five different lead supervisors as well on that college process across Europe. Also looking at some of the results, and if they're in Asia or other parts of the world, you often have those supervisors. So I was at Swiss Re the other month, and they said, oh, we've just had a college process, and we had just over 50 supervisors turn up for it. And that's huge, you know, and that's a large, large number that Swiss Re are now having to try and, you know, manage. They've gone from FINMA in Switzerland to suddenly having, you know, 50 others at the table, all wanting to know what's happening about the Swiss Re Group. So it just goes to show you the importance now of the whole sort of regulatory relationship and, you know, being able to, you know, communicate that information clearly about what's happening across the group and what that means individually at each of the different subsidiary and branch entities around the world. So this is the whole debate. You know, it went on for about 2.5 years. Are insurers systemically relevant? The industry effectively, you know, were part successful in trying to, you know, get that message across to the supervisors. But notwithstanding, because it is such a political risk that the supervisors are having to take on, it's something that they don't really just want to, you know, say, well, we'll do it ourselves. They actually want the firms to be able to demonstrate why they're not systemically relevant. So it's almost the onus is put very much squarely back on the firms, and particularly to the boards to say, why are we not in that category? And of course, you know, if there is a failure, the first people who usually, you know, the fingers start getting pointed at are the supervisors. It's quite a bit of a thankless job, actually. So if the industry is doing well for a number of years, you never hear anything, and the industry starts to say, well, what's all this regulation about? You know, maybe we should cut back the numbers, the resourcing to the supervisor. It's all costing us a lot of money. Then as soon as there is a crisis, and you saw this after HIH, suddenly it's the best thing that could happen to a prudential supervisor in a way, because you suddenly get all this extra cash coming from the government because it's a political issue and they beef up their resources. So you sort of have that cycle and we're back through a sort of another cycle now again, as it were. So if you look at the framework and what this looks like, I won't go through this because it's in the presentation notes anyway, but effectively this was a little bit of the timescale that they went through from the FSB. And then that... basically what they did is they came up with a list last July, and they said, well, we need to have a look at who is systemically relevant and who isn't. And they got together and said, okay, well, we think there's at least 9, and those 9 are up there on the screen. And then they looked at the reinsurers. You'll note that there's an absence of the reinsurers there, which you might think at first blush that's a bit odd. And why is that? A true story. The initial conversation started out with, well, FINMA, we think probably Swiss Re ought to be on the list. And FINMA then said, well, actually, if you're going to have Swiss Re on the list, maybe we should also have Munich Re. And Baffin, the German supervisor, then said, well, actually, if you're also going to have these two on the list, surely Gen Re has to be on the list as well. And then the NAIC actually came back, and this is true as I stand here, and said, well, we have a slight issue with Warren Buffett, and we don't really want to put him offside. And they couldn't agree to put Gen Re on the list. So as a result, they deferred it for 12 months. So that is why you have no reinsurers on the list, because the supervisors, in true fashion, couldn't actually agree amongst themselves as to who should be on the list. So they said, well, we'll defer it for 12 months and we'll come back. Well, that 12 months is almost up. So this June, July, they'll make another designation, and it's probably a good bet that Swiss Re, Munich Re might be on that list. We'll just have to wait and see whether Gen Re actually gets on that list. But effectively, you know, this is the state of play, and you might be sitting there thinking, well, this is all very good knowing global stuff, you know, but what relevance is this to me here in Australia? And the relevance is quite a direct one, because already some of the supervisors, like the UK PRA, are actually now changing their fundamental requirements for business. And what they've done, that's basically 8 sort of key fundamentals that they put out for all firms, including the insurers. And one of them now, one of the revised lists that's on there, is resolution. So every firm now has to be able to demonstrate how they would unwind themselves or how they would be able to be resolved in the event of a crisis. So that is quite a significant step up, if you like, in terms of the whole sort of ERM framework that's now going to be expected from insurers. Now, that is increasingly going to be cascaded across the world because all the supervisors copy each other, if you like. There's no real sort of innovation in one sense. So when we initially did, when I was at APRA years ago, doing the initial RBC framework for the GIs, we effectively copied OSFI because at the time they had the DCAP model and we thought, well, that looks a sensible RBC sort of way forward. And then when I went to the UK, we did ICAS in the UK. That looked remarkably similar to what we had just done in Australia. And of course it was, because we just brought it across. But then we sort of innovated a little bit and we said, well, maybe we should actually get everyone to try and do their own assessment of risk rather than it being a regulatory issue. And that's how ICAS was born. And then we learned from industry, actually, that it became quite quickly a compliance exercise because to come up with a 1 in 200, 99.5 level, that's what the actuaries did. So I had a team in Aviva, that's what we did. We came up with a 99.5 number and everyone looked at it and said, oh, that's interesting, and put it back on the shelf. And it soon became quite quickly a compliance exercise, you know. So it was divorced from the real sort of risk management that we didn't really speak to them. We were a small team. You had your actual risk guys. They were of minor interest in a way. You had your capital management folk. We often sort of exchanged some views, but not a lot. Then you had the finance guys. And everyone actually was in their silos. And it quite quickly was, the sort of result that this didn't really work as well as what it was envisaged to do. So then Solvency II came along. And I was asked to go back and do the Solvency II. But effectively what we learnt there was actually you need to start from an economic valuation basis. You actually need to be asking the industry to be doing their own economic assessments. And because everything else is modelled off that. So your risk frameworks, how you set capital liquidity, how you might measure all your different risk issues, all flows from your actual top sort of target rating level. So without that, actually, you'll just have a compliance exercise. But with that, you'll actually have what the firms are really doing. And then from there, you can just calibrate. It's just another calibration number at 99.5, roughly triple B. That's actually going to be pretty low for most of the rated firms. So that was the sort of rationale, if you like, for where Solvency II went to, and then the own risk and solvency assessment was the also was effectively that. Now here, of course, that's your ICAP, exactly the same thing. But that was sort of, the building rationale behind all of that. So what they're trying to do very much is sort of say, well, we'll use a lot of that material for then moving forward in terms of the policy measures. So this is where they've now come up with and said, well, firms are now starting to do that, particularly in Europe, probably not so much in the US still. It's still very much a statutory-based, sort of framework there. The Japanese, the other largest insurance market globally, is looking at all of this and sort of still deciding what they'll do, but it's pretty likely that they'll go down this route as well. And then domestically, people will start accepting this as the common way to do it. And so it is expected that APRA will next year come out formally with their requirements for the local market in terms of saying, particularly on the recovery aspects, we want to see how you actually are looking at these sorts of issues. So in terms of the policy measures, what they're really trying to drive at is, we want recovery resolution plans. We want that sort of economic capital valuation, assessment. We want that working through in terms of your stress and scenario, particularly reverse stress testing requirements. How does that feed into, the group as a whole? And what actually might you do in terms of, the issues around, liquidity and actual sort of resolution itself, So do you have a view board about what you might do if it all goes pear shape again or not? And this is one of the issues that I think pre-crisis, even with some of the UK ICAS work, no one had really gone to that resolution phase yet. So this is another, because it was always on an ongoing concern basis rather than a gone concern. And so that's the fundamental difference that you start to see. And it interestingly brings up all sorts of other issues that weren't necessarily intended at the time. So if you look at Solvency II, it's very much it was purposely built to branch across Europe. 28 member states, you can branch across. Now the thinking is, well, actually in crisis, and everyone goes native as a supervisor and everyone locks down surplus assets, actually you probably can't quickly transfer capital across the group. That was the assumption beforehand. So what happens there? So then it brings in all of these issues about, well, do you really have the diversification of these internal models that you claim you might? You know, that's always the sort of big issue now. So that is something that they're going to clearly look at, because, you know, you have an issue in Europe, ironically, where Solvency II is allowing branches, and at the same time the bankers are moving the other direction and saying, actually, we don't want branches anymore, we want subsidiaries, so we can actually lock down capital. So in those individual markets. So it's a real issue that's out there, bigger policy issues, and this is where this, you know, these crisis management groups and all of these other supervisory actions are now being formed. So just in terms of the time frame, what are we looking at? We've got effectively, they call it the Systemic Risk Management Plan, SRMP, and that's sort of midway in that sort of table there. And so what they've done, the supervisors haven't necessarily understood what they're doing, and I can say that as a former supervisor. They have set this up because they've been reacting to the banking requirements, and we said to them quite a few times, you know, it's no use putting an SRMP requirement there before recovery resolution plan comes through. So you might be asking, what the jolly is an SRMP? But effectively what they have to do by this July for those nine groups is actually look at the totality of their risks across the group and say, this is how we would think we would unwind ourselves if we had to. And these are the sort of scenarios that might get us to that breaking point of commercial insolvency. And this is what we would do working back from that. So a little bit like the reverse stress testing. Now, we've actually said to them, well, you're putting the cart before the horse, because really you've got to do the recovery resolution work first, and then out of that are effectively your management actions, which is really what the SRMP is really designed to do. But instead, you've asked for this up front before the firms have been able to actually undertake their RRP analysis. So it's a little bit, you know, back the front. But anyway, that's where we are. So come July, they have to submit these SRMPs to the supervisors. The supervisors will then look at that from the IAS and actually take a view as to what they then next do. The RRPs will be due by the end of the year. So, you know, this is a key area, effectively, for what a lot of the large groups are now having to do in Europe. They're trying to bank off, you know, a lot of the work that they've done in Solvency II for the European groups. For the US groups, this is all new territory for some of them, because they're now having to go to the Federal Reserve, who are now going to oversight effectively these large insurance groups. So that is a departure in the US. And in Japan, of course, they don't really do economic capital valuation modelling at all. And so this is a huge new area for them. So they've been caught short as well. Because suddenly they're doing a field testing task force now. They want to know what some of these requirements might look like. They're asking for data straight away. And a lot of these large groups cannot supply the information. And so at the moment there is, just as an aside, there is a field testing task force that's now underway to look at the common framework for supervising internationally active insurance groups, what they call ComFrame. And so ComFrame is working in parallel to this GC development, because the GC has been really a here and now from the FSB. But longer term, the vision is that the IAS would actually have a global accord that they would supervise all insurance firms under. So a little bit like your Basel equivalent for the insurance sector. So they have about, on the list at the moment, 25 internationally active insurance groups. Those 25 aren't necessarily the GCs, because there's only 9 of those. But effectively what they're trying to do is broaden the base of their field testing task force, effectively undertaking a quiz exercise, a quantitative impact study, around what the RBC of the future might look like for these large internationally active insurance groups. So there's a whole lot of work going on in this next few years around what that all might look like. So just moving on, given the time, you know, what are the core components of an RRP? What will that look like? Very much around, you know, you've got these sort of economic function identification type pieces. You know, what are the key economic functions within your business? So they really want to know what they are, and, you know, what are some of these barriers to resolution that you might confront. And for a lot of firms, this is new territory, because they haven't had to go down this route before. You know, on a going concern basis, you're not necessarily worried about how you would wind yourself up. So this is this is something new that is causing a lot of interest for those groups, because it's how much work do you do? To what degree do you go and actually put these resolution plans in place? And so one of the interesting features that comes up, for example, is, you know, around some of your banking caveats that you might have. You know, often they will apply first before any of the solvency measures of the supervisors do. And, you know, unless you actually go through a process like this, you're not necessarily thinking that that would be a key requirement in the issue of a resolution. Or, you know, what you might do in terms of shared service centres within the group. You know, so on the banking side, they had this very much an issue. When some of the large banking groups collapsed, all of the IT infrastructure was in another entity, which actually went altogether, and they were left short. So they just didn't think through, you know, what the implications were across the group for some of these issues like shared service centres. So, you know, this is the sort of new area that you start to get into to say, well, what would we do? What are our key dependencies internally within the group across the whole raft of issues that you're looking at? So that's what they're really firmly now going to move into, particularly at the group level. And you've got this issue between legal entity and group-wide, and this is why the supervisors are very much wanting to, you know, have control of the group holding company, because, you know, they know that if they don't get control of that at that level, then actually, you know, it's very difficult to control the rest of the group underneath, particularly in times of crisis. So it's very much moving towards that. The SRMP, I've got there on the screen, you know, just what the key differences are between resolution and SRMP. I think we've probably spoken a lot anyway about some of those issues. But suffice to say, you know, again, this is something that they really want the boards to be owning, and they really want the boards to be dictating, you know, to the management team. You know, we actually want to see analysis around these sorts of areas. Now, that causes its own interesting issues anyway, but effectively it's around those core areas of NT&I, so they really want the boards to understand that, and they really, because they're saying you don't understand your exposures enough. And if you did, you should be questioning, you know, what the management team are doing. And this whole issue, as I said, around particularly annuities. So there's a whole sort of, you know, work program that's now particularly in play across those large nine groups. And so you get this sort of, you know, situation where you have to say, well, you know, what would the sort of, what is a simple decision tree framework that you might have under these sorts of areas? So, you know, initial decision, is it systemic, the activity we're doing? Yes, no. If it's a no, then it becomes into the standard supervision sort of framework and you don't have to do anything special. If it's yes, then you go down, is it resolvable? Question mark. You know, how well could we actually unwind some of this? If it's resolvable, then that's got to go into and be documented into the resolution plan as well. If it's not resolvable, that also goes down into another layer of treatment. You know, so how would we actually then, you know, look at, you know, managing those sorts of risks. So is it, for example, we might have to, you know, unwind some of those positions or not? And again, that has to be documented. And just in terms of what would you do under those sorts of scenarios and how would you actually take the management actions you need to? That is really, effectively, that's quite a simple sort of overlay, but that's what they're really trying to do at the core of it, undertake this sort of assessment. So the NT&I principles, the IAS came out with a whole host of, you know, guidelines effectively for what, you know, might be considered that. But effectively, rather than going through each one, what you've really got are those assets which really give rise to sort of the market risk elements in terms of the NT&I. And so what they're going to do is say, well, we want to know what your positions are around, you know, capital and liquidity in particular, around some of those derivatives and swaps and CDSs that you might have on the books, and how you would actually, you know, put the better controls in place so that you don't end up with another sort of financial products division type scenario. So that at the core is what they're trying to avoid going forward. So what they've done is they then classified the insurance activities into these groups, and they said, well, here's the traditional lot of activities and here is what we think are non-traditional. You know, and again, you can imagine some of this has caused a little bit of heat in the industry about whether, things are necessarily, traditional or non-traditional. But, particularly around the annuities, and that's caused quite a little bit of, friction. But the supervisors will come back and say, well, yes, but, if we listen to the industry all the time, everything is always core. And that can't be true. You're always innovating, you're always going down certain routes. And at particular times, products over time becoming standard, but at certain points at the beginning, they're probably still, non-traditional in that true sense. So you've got this sort of, those sort of guaranteed investment contracts, all those sort of synthetic contracts, mortgage insurance, all of those sorts of elements, particularly as I mentioned with a large market risk component, actually become classified as NT&I. So then you say, what does all this mean in practice? And what is this going to look like going forward? And effectively, you've got this sort of scenario where you've got your recovery plan on one hand and you've got your resolution on the other. And the recovery plan is very much saying, what is the point of insolvency, and working back, what are your trigger points and your management actions that you could take before you get there as solvency declines? So very much similar to what people are now needing to do anyway in terms of the reverse stress test analysis. The resolution then goes into, the next phase and says, well, what would happen around significant legal entities? What would you do to unwind some of that business? How would you actually look at, different markets in terms of the importance to the group? What would that be to, say, your reputation, intergroup transactions, financial flows? What would happen if, every supervisor does in a crisis say, we're not going to allow surplus assets to flow out of the country? What would that mean for your liquidity and capital purposes? So this is why it's quite new and challenging, because a lot of the firms haven't necessarily had to go through that sort of analysis before. The models have taken quite a lot of diversification benefit, thinking that there is, the transferability and fungibility of capital, which is now, starting to say, well, maybe it's not. And what would happen under that scenario, and how much capital do you need? And what would you do if, under those scenarios, you can't do what you thought you might have done on an ongoing concern basis? And this is why it's all very challenging for a lot of the groups, because that takes an enormous amount of work, as you could imagine, for some of these large groups, to how they would actually tackle that sort of analysis. And, of course, it's on the banking side in particular, it's highly sensitive within the group, because it's not as though you can just call up someone in X country and say, well, actually, if we were to get in a crisis again, you're the first one gone, and you'd be out. So no one wants to hear that. So they also have that internal issue about how they manage some of those messages and that analysis. So it's always very tightly controlled at the group, because it's not something you really want a lot of the subsidiaries knowing necessarily, that they're not core to the group. So that brings up a whole host of, interesting issues internally anyway. So what does that mean for the business activities? How might that impact? Very much this is an area that, as we mentioned, you've got to have the systemic risk management plan by July this year, the recovery resolution plan by the end of this year. I think the supervisors are genuinely uncertain at this stage as to what this really means for them in practice, because they haven't actually got the results yet from the firms, those nine firms who are in this group. But I think it's fair to say that the pressure from the FSB and the pressure above that in terms of the G20 is such that they have to do something, and this is why they are going to keep on working up the ComFrame proposals, because at the moment there isn't a global framework for the insurance sector, and so they know that they have to deliver on that core issue going forward, not least because they need a mechanism in which to then set capital and other requirements for these GCs against. Because otherwise, if you do actually have a crisis, and let's say it's one of the UK groups, then is it the UK requirements which are at play here? Is it the other major subsidiaries? Are there, supervisors will have a certain view on what that should look like. How do you actually, amongst themselves properly unwind such a large group. Really contentious. So this is why they need these sorts of issues ironed out. I put there on the bottom, you know, we think this is highly likely APRA will apply similar expectations for the large domestic insurance groups. I think that is a given. We've had some initial discussions with them. They know they're a little bit behind. It was meant to be this year, actually, that they were going to come out with something. They've been a little bit distracted. They're now saying, we think we're going to be working up something for next year. And the reason why they have to is because, you know, if you look at HIH, I mean, Australia's always held up as the case example of a systemic risk case. And they will say, well, actually, it wasn't, you know, HIH wasn't globally, you know, significant. You know, very big impact on the Australian market, but actually it wasn't a global SIFI, if you like. Nonetheless, it was domestically significant for APRA, politically, you know, very... you know, hot issue for the government of the day. And so this is why, you know, at the domestic level, you look at a lot of the, say, the Japanese groups as well, a lot of them are not necessarily global, systemically important institutions, but they're very much a domestic relevance. So this is something that will cascade through in time. And you'll see there that, you know, in terms of that, well, how would you approach that? What would you look at? Well, you've got the resolution plan. There's a lot of initial program governance you need around, you know, which entities, which different divisions within internally are going to you have on the program, because it requires, it goes across everything. So this is not just something that the risk team could do in splendid isolation. This has to have the involvement of everyone across the group. Then you're looking at what structuring implications might be there, which is, you know, something which you can't do quickly, and then particularly around, you know, what aspects of risk management do you need to actually improve on. So there's a whole sort of array of different issues which come into play doing this whole sort of future work, and something which is probably likely to be coming Australia's way next year with their with the large domestic players here. But having said that, it's also probably something which the supervisors will increasingly say, well, we just think this is part of good risk management anyway, and we think it should be cascaded down even further below the large groups. So you always start with the large groups, and then, you know, good supervisory practice, you then end up applying that to everyone. A little bit like Basel, it was only intended for the large groups, and suddenly it became the global standard for all banks. So you will find that, you know, over time, insurance will have something very similar. But I'll leave that there now, and James, open up for some questions if there are any.
Yeah, look, thanks very much, Rob. If anyone has any questions, come to the microphone and state your name first. I guess the purpose of our presentation today was we have gone deliberately quite long into the presentation because we know it's a very new concept to those in Australia and probably not something they've been very familiar with. For those that are part of banking groups, you may have seen that they've rolled out RRPs amongst the big four banks. APRA's already done it to the second tier, and they're about to start rolling it down to credit unions and the smaller banks. So the expectations that they've set informally is it is coming to insurance companies in the next 12 to 18 months. So a lot of this definitions and acronyms, which there are many, will be coming your way very shortly, we expect. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to, or comments they'd like to come to the microphone?
Rob, what do you think the regulator does with this information? So they find out that, you know, in the global group, they plan on jettisoning the Australian operation, or within an Australian group, you plan on jettisoning the life company. Hmm. Obviously, those individual subsidiaries don't know, but APRA does. What do you reckon APRA does with this information in terms of managing those companies, knowing that the first on a crisis, the group's going to jettison them?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, because that's what will happen. Effectively, you know, when they, because they're all part of the colleges process now, you know, and APRA is an active participant in a lot of the large groups, you know, with the large, with the certain subsidiaries and branches over here in Australia. So they are very much plugged into what's happening on the college process, and that's where exactly these discussions are going to be held. So what you'll have is a process post-July where the home supervisor gets those results, they start coming through this, And they start to then, you know, look at basically the global perspective, you know, of that particular group. And they say, what is the effect? You know, we can see that actually the plan of this group is to do exactly that. You know, we're going to hive off these sorts of areas if we needed to, or we'll close those down, or we won't fund them any further, or we'll run them off. Now, that is an unknown area, if you like, at this stage for the other supervisors, because I think a lot of them are quite concerned, if you like, that they might actually get those, that very analysis, Praylin, and then, what do we do? And that will be something that I think is going to require quite a lot of discussion, if you like, between those supervisors, because they're making this up, if you like, as they go. This is sort of policy on the run a little bit, because they're in a live situation. You know, this is not something where they've had time to develop the policy and then try and implement it. They're trying to develop the policy and get the firms to actually undertake the analysis at the same time. So they're both running, if you like, with this, and they're running because they have to, because the FSB is saying we want an answer on this, and if you don't, we'll apply something ourselves, and that will probably look banking-esque. So this is why there is tremendous pressure. I think it's fair to say that the supervisory community is probably going to be a lot wiser post-July, and again early next year when they really get the recovery resolution plan material. I think that will help shape, if you like, the ComFrame developments and discussions, because that will really frame, you know, what are the key areas that they need to build in terms of this risk-based capital framework that they're now trying to do for ComFrame, and the associated Pillar 2 and Pillar 3 elements, if you like.
Time for one last question, perhaps. All right, well, if everyone join me, please, just thanking Rob Curtis for the presentation today.
Thank you.